Hi everyone, welcome to Amplify Her Science Stories, the official podcast of the Yale Ventures Amplify Her Science Initiative. I'm your host, Megha Anelkar, and we have such a special episode planned for you today. It's part two with Claudia. Drum roll, please. Yay! I'll be co-hosting this podcast with my colleague and dear friend, Jennifer Beecham. If you remember, she's hosted a couple of other episodes as well. So as you know, she's a pro at it. Jen is the Associate Director of Blavatnik Fund for Innovation and helps faculty members translate early stage life sciences discoveries into fundable, high impact biomedical products and facilitates the formation of commercial partnerships. She's coming from developmental stage pharma with a ton of relevant experience in finance, corporate strategy, commercial launch preparation, and I also know she's worked in a rare disease, which is a special thing in itself. Jen holds a BA in biochemistry, a BS in engineering, and an MS in engineering from UPenn. Personally, I cannot thank Jen for being her amazing self. Can you believe she just ran the New York Marathon? She's a true champion, not just in running, but also for EHS, and an enthusiastic foodie. I do really miss our hot pot lunches, but it's always so nice to host an episode with her. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you, Megha, for that wonderful introduction. I love hosting with you and I miss our lunches as well, but it's great to be here and catch up and chat and be with our fantastic guests on this podcast. So today we're back with Claudia, and a quick intro again in case you haven't heard part one. Claudia Reuter is the director of the Roberts Innovation Fund at Yale Ventures, recognized by the Boston Business Journal as a 2016 Woman to Watch in Science and Technology and as a changemaker by Hub Week. Claudia is an experienced entrepreneur, corporate executive, and board director. And we're back here today to learn more about her business experiences, her experiences fundraising, as well as being a funder. So Claudia, we're so excited to have you on our podcast.
I'm so excited to be back. It's great to connect again.
So let's start with the inspiration for your book. We want to revisit the book in this podcast. I know we talked a little bit about it in the first one, but can you start with your inspiration?
Yeah. So, well, a couple of things. I think as you've probably seen, and we're, you know, I think everyone at Amplify Her is aware of the stats for women who have venture-backed companies, who are in leadership positions at large organizations, who make it to a board seat, actually don't reflect the education level of women. You know, more than 50% of women are college educated, and yet the other stats are not where I would think they should be. So I started noticing these stats in terms of the smaller percentage of women getting funding, the smaller percentage of women with truly a seat at the executive table. And in parallel, when I was in an executive role at HMH and throughout my career, I had an opportunity to interview a lot of people over the years. And one thing I kept noticing a pattern on was that women who may have stepped away from the workforce for caregiving often apologized for their time away, were willing to come in at a lower position. And I didn't see the same pattern for men who may have taken a break or stepped away for caregiving. And so I just started to do research on, you know, what are the reasons behind all of this? What are the biases? And we talked about some of this in the last episode, so I won't go too deep on it. But what really inspired me to write the book was that I realized that many of the constraints and many of the challenges I think that we see for women in the world of work comes from a world of work that was not designed with women in mind. And so I think one of the, you know, we can continue to apply pressure to organizations to change corporate structures, to really think about how we can do things differently, moving away from some of the standard things we all think of for 9 to 5 and whatnot. But we can also encourage people to consider entrepreneurship as a path forward. Being an entrepreneur allowed me, as someone who did step away from my career for some time, gave me a path to a set of experiences I never would have had in a more siloed career, gave me visibility across a whole lot of areas, and really allowed me to go in at a much higher level ultimately when my company was acquired and moved on to an SVP level. So I started to think about, you know, could I write a book that would both be, you know, sort of a manifesto for women or people who identify as women to consider entrepreneurship as a path forward. And at the same time, try to give people practical takeaways and resources to make that journey a little bit easier.
You know, the title of your book is Yes, You Can Do This. So can you tell me what was the, maybe it was a trigger or somebody who pushed you, or what was the thing that told you that you could do this and go into the entrepreneurial role?
That's such a fun question. I've had a lot of very different experiences, a very nonlinear career path. And when I stepped away from the workforce, I had been in a sort of a high tech environment and an investment bank. And when I stepped away, when I had my first son, for a lot of reasons, not because I was becoming a lady who lunches or something, but rather because I really was dedicated to providing primary care. And I also didn't see a path to making my life work with the job that I had and the resources I had at the time. But when I was ready to really re-enter the quote traditional world, I felt all like similar confidence issues that I think a lot of people experience, where I wasn't sure if my skills were going to still be, you know, what they needed to be to come back in, if I had the right degree anymore, if any of these things mattered. And I also, in parallel, noticed a number of opportunities for really bringing technology into this. I suddenly went from high tech investment bank world to mom and caregiving world, where at that point there was actually very little technology, and I hungered for that. So on one hand, I was just motivated to actually create, you know, systems and tools that could make my life and other people's lives easier who were in the caregiving world. But also it became a path to step back into the world of work on my own terms with my own schedule and, you know, the way I wanted to do it.
I love that. I also love the fact that Jen called it a manifestation related title versus just, you know, like it's so much more motivating, especially when you have a book that tells you that, look, here's how you can do it. This is how I did it, and absolutely love it. The other thing that I really like is you both set the stage for today's episode. Today, guys, we're going to talk about funding. That's it. Funding, funding, funding. Claudia is amazing at it. She has been on both sides. She has done fundraising, and she's also been on the other side of the table where she has given money. And I have had the good luck in my life to be friendly with Claudia, where we've had conversations where, you know, we've spoken about women applicants for funding don't necessarily raise enough money or any money at all as compared to their male counterparts. Many other things are involved, you know. It's not just gender bias. It's also related to color and state or age in life. But it does boil down a lot to identifying as women versus men. And not just that, you know, funny story that I remember Claudia mentioned was how there is a sort of bro culture, even on the funder side, right? I remember it doesn't even have to be funding. Even if you find a group of people which are just men, even as a lab in grad school, women don't tend to go to them, you know, those labs, because it is a certain culture that is inherited in certain places. So we've had many conversations related to that. And I'm hoping today we can take the time with Jen and Claudia to talk about that. So first question, very important one. Which side did you like, Claudia? Funding or being a funder yourself?
I mean, I think I had different answers depending on the stage of life I was at. So right now, and when I was I prefer to be on the providing of funds and hopefully making an impact in that way. You know, you started to raise the question about, you know, the variance in raising dollars that go to women versus men. And I thought I would just highlight that really quick, that one, for the, there's many, many, many different ways people can raise capital for their companies. It doesn't all need to be venture, right? So it really depends on what is the type of business you're trying to build. But of those who go for venture capital funding, bless you, Jen, of those who go for venture capital funding, a very small percentage of all those who go for a get it, I believe it's like 1% of people who try to get venture actually get venture. But of that 1%, only 3% goes to women. And that number kind of varies every year. Sometimes we make strides and it's 3.8%, and sometimes it goes back down and it's 2.8. So you're looking at a very, very small percentage of the small percentage that actually get capital. And I'd love to dive into why that may be and answer any questions you have.
Yeah, maybe we can start with that. Like, not just the small percentage within venture capital. We've also heard that when women raise a Series A, it's often smaller than if a male founder were to raise that same series. Can you dive into that one on the small percentage as well as just the amount that women are able to raise?
Yeah, I think there's so many different, there's a couple of different levers or variables that go into this. I think one to start with is when you're going for, and this does go back to some unconscious bias, but there's actually a study around this, which is interesting related to fundraising. So when you are trying to raise capital for a venture funded business, what you're really trying to convey to that investor is that this thing you're doing could have massive, massive potential for scale, right? And that means you have to convince and talk to the funder about the possibility and the world of opportunity. And the minute you start to talk about the risk and the downside and the potential for me, well, maybe I couldn't get that big, but I could get just this big. I think sometimes what females tend to do is talk about things in a way that they believe they're being pragmatic, but it may send a signal to the investor that they're not thinking big enough. And so you have on one side, you know, someone may be trying to raise that capital and be nervous about saying it's too big because it won't seem realistic. But really, even the smallest number is not realistic because the odds of a startup working are very small, right? So, you know, one, being able to articulate how big your vision is. Two, there's actually been a study that shows investors will often ask women more risk associated questions than their male counterparts. And this goes back to some weird unconscious bias where women are perceived as less responsible with money because of the motherhood penalty, that all women, if you're of childbearing age, are considered less reliable, less trusted with money than their male counterpart who might have a family, is perceived as more responsible, more reliable. So when you get into investor meetings, it's very common for an investor to start to say, oh, well, that's a big idea you have, but tell me about the downside. Tell me about how you're, what might go wrong. Now, it doesn't mean that a man never gets that question. They probably do. But when they get it, they're more likely to say, well, of course there might be risk, but let's not talk about that right now. Let's talk about the opportunity. And because a woman may feel a more unconscious need to be compliant and to get the answer right, they may actually be more inclined to say, you're right, there is a risk. Let me tell you about all the risks and all the problems. So some of these are like subtle under the, you know, unconscious things that happen, and we do it on all sides of the table. So I think one, just being aware of that, but I think that is sometimes how things come undone. And then you're not able to raise as much because you haven't conveyed that the possibility is big enough, and you haven't dealt with probably the bias of the investor who unconsciously or not is thinking that you won't make it as big. So those are some of the factors, I think.
What are some of the practical tools you used when you were getting questions like that, or you saw that the conversation was really focusing on the downside? How did you turn that around to the opportunity?
Well, it's funny because I wasn't aware of any of this research when I was trying to raise money for my own efforts. I was just doing my thing and trying my best. And probably, you know, I have plenty of things I could probably go back and do differently. But this all came about after the fact, when I started looking into the data more. And then I started seeing patterns among applicants I was getting when I was a managing director at Techstars. And so this risk opportunity exercise is actually something I took founders through in workshops during our accelerator to try to, you know, prepare people for, hey, if you get these types of questions, how can you deal with it? Because they're not obvious. And when you're isolated in a meeting, you don't even, and again, if you think you're giving the right answer, you're not even aware, you know, it's really a matter of you have to control the narrative and the story you're trying to tell versus responding to the way someone else is trying to take it. But at the same time, being coachable, there's all sorts of weird nuance, nuance moments here.
You know, when you bring that up, we've often heard the feedback that investors want to, they ask a question and it's really, they're getting at the question behind the question, but the person who might be a technical expert might not realize the larger business implication. Have you seen a difference between the way male founders and the way women founders answer those types of questions and knowing the context?
I think that I've seen a difference between the way that highly technical founders, period, tend to answer things versus maybe less technical founders who are more commission or business focused. So I think, I don't know that I've necessarily seen it on gender, but I have seen instances where, you know, with coaching, you can say, you know, when you get this type of question, let's go back to what are you like, I think getting someone aligned on what is your goal when you go into that meeting? Is it to take them through every detail of your technical evidence for why this is correct and why this is going to work and all that? Or is it to help them understand why this thing you've done, which you have credibility to have done, is going to have an amazing, significant impact on the world, and just helping people realize that they can, they have to get someone over to that vision area.
So what are the top three things you would advise on for controlling that narrative and really telling that story?
I think one, a lot of this goes into pre-work before you even get to a conversation. So one, you know, I think sometimes people view, like, for example, the financial model as something that has to be like 100% correct in some way. And, you know, it becomes a supporting piece. I think starting in some way with your financial model for yourself to help build out one, what is my vision? Well, you know, well, one, what problem am I solving? Right. Two, like, what is my vision? Where do I think if I had all the resources in the world, if I had, you know, trillions of dollars, what could I do? How far could I take this? And then getting back into your Excel sheet and walking yourself back to today from 5 years from now and thinking about all the different levers you'll need to get to that positive outcome so that you feel like you've got all of the sort of nuts and bolts and answers ready. Because again, the financial model is never going to be right, but it gives the investor a window into how you're thinking about your business. And do you understand the levers that you'll have to work with over time in order to get to your outcome? So preparing your vision, your problem statement, your, you know, your desired use of funds and how you would deploy those. I think one of the mistakes I've heard people make sometimes is saying, well, I just need $1 million to run the business for the next 2 years, right? Versus I'm trying to get to target A, and in order to get there, I will need to deploy 200K here, 300K here, 400K, whatever it is. And so, you know, thinking in terms of what's my goal and how am I going to deploy resources to get there versus I just need resources to keep making progress. Thinking about that and then being prepared for that meeting to always be redirecting back to where you're going to take them, because ultimately they're giving you money so you can deploy it, so you can achieve a future goal. So helping them understand how you're going to deploy their capital in a way that's going to make them more successful too is super important.
I had actually a quick question, Claudia. This is not directly related to someone who's fundraising, but it is, and it's an important one. You mentioned people who are more on the technical side, independent of their genders, right? People who tend to be more of scientists or engineers tend to answer questions in a very different manner than how someone who possibly has come out of a B school and all they've done their life is strategy work or corporate development. They think more on the business end. And all of us over here on the podcast have been lucky to be on both sides. So I kind of understand the problem you are talking about. Now, one thing you mentioned, which I thought is extremely important, is coachability, right? You mentioned that you were just doing your thing, but you did something really right to be this successful. Just trying to tie that all together, for someone who doesn't have the tools to raise money and needs to be coachable, how does one find coaches or how does one think about it? Because this is an important point, right? This is not just about having like a Gantt chart and putting in some projections that you've pulled in from global data or wherever. So how do you do that?
Well, I think, you know, and maybe this does go back to some of my previous life experience, but I think that it starts with you have before you can be coachable, you have to be curious and flexible, right? And so in every community, I think you can, or not every community, but in a lot of communities, you can start to look for what are the events happening in, you know, within an hour of me that I can maybe get to, whether it's virtual or in person, where maybe there's other startup founders there, where there are other investors there. I'm sure even in New Haven, there's been a number of events just in the last couple of weeks, I think I've been aware of. The idea is find your people, right? Like before you even get there, you'll develop pattern recognition, listening to other people as they're talking about their businesses and what's working and what's not. So starting from kind of finding your other people in similar situations to you. And typically in those types of events too, you'll find people who are open to being a coach or being a mentor. When you get a little bit further along, if you really are, you know, you've gone past the first few steps and you're like, okay, I'm ready to really do this. And you are truly seeking, you know, funding and mentorship, you know, programs like Techstars or like Y Combinator, those exist to do those things. And so, and I, you know, like Techstars, I know has an accelerator in almost every city around the world at this point. And it's not to say that you're necessarily going to be accepted into one of those programs because they have a very, very small acceptance rate. But they are, those types of organizations typically have weekend events, community events that they sponsor. So there's lots of ways to get engaged. I also think being unafraid of learning new things and being willing to say what you don't know is really important. Like, I think where people, it's hard to be an entrepreneur or to do anything, as you know, if you're not willing to say what you don't know, and then either learn it or find someone who can fill in the gap on your team for you. So those were things I tried to do.
Going back to your experiences in fundraising and then looking into the research of unconscious bias, how did you apply these learnings to when you became a funder and setting up your own framework of evaluating these companies?
Yeah. So I think I had a nice sort of, I had a little bit of distance between when I was in that world of fundraising and when I stepped into the world of Techstars and became an MD investor, because I was an executive at the company that acquired my company for several years. And that's when I really got, those years were formative in learning a lot more about, sort of reflecting on my own experience, but learning a lot more about unconscious bias and the different things I was seeing for women throughout the larger organizations I was a part of or interacting with. When part of the reason I joined Techstars at that point, unrelated to me, it's an amazing organization, and they had at a leadership level recognized on their own that if we want to see more women founders, we need more representation in the investment community, because it's very hard for you. These are all unconscious things. No one's trying to be mean. No one's trying to be exclusive. I think actually everyone wants to be inclusive, or most people do, but there's these under the hood things that happen. People are more likely to invest in people who look like them or had similar experiences to them because they intrinsically like trust that person. And so leadership at Techstars recognized that they needed to make a conscious choice to try to attract more female MDs. So I think I benefited from their decision making to come in as an MD. I think there were probably also a lot of super qualified candidates who would have been happy to have the role that I had at the time. time. So I feel very fortunate that they were taking that on. Jenny Lawton at the time was someone who was like one of my key interviewers. And I know that that was, you know, something she had talked about. And so anyway, I came into it kind of full eyes open on, you know, I need to be thinking about this position I'm in now and how I make sure that we create the world we want to see, right? One of the other things we started to do was say, okay, say you get to, you have hundreds and hundreds of applications. When you get to your top 25, let's make sure that, you know, keep taking a look. Do we have 50%? At least 50% of these should have a female founder. So, you know, there's a conscious being, I think being conscious in seeking out, you know, representation is important. Like, it's never going to be perfect, but trying to look for ways that your applicant pool reflects your community at the very least, I think is really important. And then some of it is, you know, peer check-in. I remember in my first few weeks, as an MD, one of the things we would do is have like a very junior, like associate person who, like in our case, it was someone was interning from a local college doing videography work for us, like trying to capture all the fun moments that were happening and then playing it back in little reels. And I didn't think anything of it. It was just a fun video. And I got a call from another MD who's she's awesome, Jenny Fielding. She's now got her own fund. And she said, I think that the person doing your videography it's got his own biased lens because you're not in any of the video. And of course I would never have asked to be in any of the video, right? I'm like, I don't need to be in the video, but you know, she's like, you're not in any of the video. None of your female mentors are in the video. All the sort of power shots are with men. And it was all unconscious. And all we had to do was have a simple conversation with him and say, hey, could you kind of make sure you're positioning this correctly so that we get more female mentors who are perceived as credible and all that. And it took him 2 seconds and he did it. But that was something I didn't even realize was happening because I was too in it to even know that it mattered. And so I was grateful to Jenny that she highlighted that for me.
That's great to hear. You know, when women help out other women, I've noticed also just at networking events, right? Sometimes the women get left to the side and nobody talks to them, or we have our own unconscious bias view of, you know, taking a look at this room and somehow deciding to navigate to all the older people who happen to be men. Yeah. And so I've noticed just in my own experience that senior women will approach me and they've taken me under their wing. And that's been so nice because we will look out for each other during these times where you're trying to make new connections and new forays into this ecosystem.
Oh, I think it's so important. And I try to do it now as someone on the other side of the journey, because I remember going to one of these community networking events at one point when I was much younger, right? I was in my early 30s, late 20s or whatever. And I got to this event and it was all men and all, you know, who knows? And I don't even remember the name of the event. It was just like a community kind of event in New York somewhere. But the first person to approach me came up to me and said, oh, hey, you must be handing out badges. Can I get my badge? And I'm like, no, yeah. I'm not the badge person.
Oh, I have a funny story to share. I was once in a very important meeting and I was fundraising for something that I was doing and I was leading. And I walked in and someone actually asked me, when will the lunch be there? And I was like, I don't understand. Is it because I'm brown or woman or young? Because I check all those boxes, but whatever it is, I'm not sure if I want your money anymore, you know? And I love that you both make a very good point, right? Women have to play nice in the sandbox.
Yep.
And even men have to be very conscious of it, because and please correct me if I'm wrong, both of you, but I've sometimes seen that when you walk into boardrooms, women will always tend to take the seats that are closer to the wall and not at the table. And I have had that feeling as well, where I'm like, maybe I'm not important enough, but I've just tried to teach myself that if I'm invited to a meeting, I am important. Otherwise I won't be invited.
Good. Yeah. You know who does a great job? Jennifer McFadden here at Yale. I remember visiting her class over in SOM, and she had a whole exercise where she was making sure people were sitting in the right spots or aware of what message they were sending based on the seats they were choosing.
And it's so important, especially if you are in a world where you have to raise money or give money, right? Not that it's not important in other fields, but here it is so cutthroat, so competitive that if you are not doing a good job of not just your science, but also selling yourself, you're probably not going to be successful. And that's just how the world is. It's just extremely competitive. So,
you know, I want to go back to a point you brought up, Megha, about male allies and how there are men who are changing their unconscious bias and becoming aware of some of these things. Claudia, can you just talk about your experience with that and how you've seen and experienced male allies while you're a funder?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I've shared this before, too. I mean, some of the best mentors I've had, the best allies I've had, obviously are men. I think when we're talking about these sort of big bucket challenges, right, of women not having as much funding as men or the challenges, it's not because it's an us versus them. These are just deeply rooted unconscious bias challenges that I truly believe once you start to bring it to light, people turn, you know, flip a switch and are like, oh, well, that obviously that's not what I was intending. And they do want to change. So I have rarely encountered anyone, male or female, once they start to be aware, who don't change how they're behaving, or how they're acting. And so, and I've definitely, you know, I mean, I think actually, you know, going back to Techstars and their intentionality around bringing in female MDs, I think that's a testament to their leadership, who at the time was primarily male, right? I mean, they recognized that, and there's monetary benefits too, right? There's evidence to support that more diverse leadership teams have better innovation, better outcomes. It's not just a nice to have a diverse board of directors. It actually leads to better outcomes for your company. And the same goes for your portfolio. You need to have a diversified portfolio in order to increase the odds of success. So you have an arbitrage moment if you start to invest in more people who are not necessarily who you would think of, right?
You talked about that as one of the points for funders who are looking to break unconscious bias is taking a hard look when your portfolio isn't representing the diverse amount of founders who are out there. So have you had an experience where you guys did take a hard look and look at reasons why it wasn't as diverse, and what were some of the reasons you uncovered?
Well, in a way, one, I think a side point on that question is I can give you a real world example on like my second year portfolio. I had 50% of, we ended up out of 10 companies, 50% had a female founder. So we achieved, you know, it was, but I'll tell you one thing that was interesting was that we had a very large mentor community and we were doing hard tech, right? We had additive manufacturing, sustainable packaging tech. And I remember being asked by someone, oh, let me guess, all the AM companies are run by men. And I'm like, no, actually, that's not true at all. And actually, there's quite a few women in this space who are incredibly brilliant and capable of doing, you know, whatever, obviously. But so even within that moment of having equal representation, there was still a bias that the most technical things must still have a guy attached to it. And so again, it just goes back to re-educating and re-communicating that's just not how it works.
So. That is actually funny. People still have these biases because, you know, you need to use your brain and have the ability to think and good at your job.
Do you think there is a thing, there is another bias I've seen where a male CEO of a startup is not as likely to be asked about the qualifications of his technical co-founder or where the technical co-founder is. They will be much more likely, or people generally I've noticed will be much more likely to just accept that he's got it. Don't worry. He wouldn't have gotten this far without figuring something out. And I've definitely seen more questions towards females to be like, well, I don't know if I can invest. I don't think you have a technical co-founder. And they may not actually need one. They may have figured out another path or way to actually, you know, whatever. And so that's another one I've seen.
It's my standing joke. I don't understand. What can I do better than going to Ivy Leagues, getting a PhD postdoc, blah, blah, blah. And still I'm not good enough. Like, what do you want? And that's not me, right? That's all the women. Any sort of industry, you have to struggle with this.
Yeah. And then like one of the other things we unfortunately, you know, coached different founders on was women in particular being very clear about your credentials up front, because it just takes all the question, and not that you should have to do that, but just putting it out there removes all the bias that might be filtering and you know, floating around you and you're not even aware of it. But when someone comes right out and says, "Hi, I'm so-and-so and I have a PhD in XYZ and I'm here to tell you about what I'm building," you immediately snap the credibility issue.
Mm-hmm. So. See, but this might be a more of a philosophical question, but food for thought for everyone, including you both. Do you really need to do that? You know, you have a presentation and you have data supporting what you're doing. It doesn't matter what your education level is. Yes, certain technical fields do need a PhD or a master's or an MBA or a bachelor's or whatever degree you're looking at. But is it actually required in literally everything that you do? And I think it's more of a supporting hero for someone who has some bias against them and not necessarily for everyone. So, you know, it's kind of philosophical. That world is not fair, but it annoys me.
You know, I'm with you. You shouldn't, I don't think you should have to, but if you have it, it doesn't hurt to say it. It can only help, but yeah, there's plenty of successful male founders I can think of who were college dropouts, right?
And very unsuccessful ones as well, who have high education, right? Like, look at the world where it's going and you see these men having losses of millions and millions of dollars that can be used to cure cancer or do other important things, and it's just wasted.
You've spoken a lot about your experiences both being a fundraiser and a funder and how you have grown from working outside of the entrepreneurial mindset and then entering the entrepreneurial space. Can you talk about your journey and how the growth mindset has really helped with that, and what advice you have for others around that growth mindset, whether they are thinking about becoming an entrepreneur or already are one?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and Carol Dweck has a great book on growth mindset, so I encourage anyone to read that. I read that and it helped me quite a bit. But I think there's a couple of key takeaways that have informed my thinking and how not only how I work with people on teams, but also engage with my own family and my own kids. And so one piece of it comes just into like the language that we use. And so if you describe someone as, "Hey, you're so smart," you're really kind of sending the message like you've got it all figured out, and you're either, and if someday you don't have it figured out, you might feel bad about that. So you become less willing to try new things. Whereas if you can instead say to someone, "Wow, I really appreciate how much work you put into that. It looks like you're on a path to something interesting," or whatever, you know, "I really appreciate how inquisitive you are about that." You're encouraging a growing behavior. You're encouraging someone to be willing to take that step and take that challenge. And so when you're in a fixed mindset, you're limiting the world of possibility. And so helping yourself and helping others just always be learning and realizing that the act of learning, the act of doing is as much the reward as the outcome. You'll achieve the outcome and then you'll be bored and you'll need to go do something else. So you have to enjoy the process of getting where you're going. And I always try to be mindful of that in my own day, in my own life, but also realizing that the words I use to compliment others or encourage others can actually foster a growth mindset or a fixed mindset. The other thing with a fixed mindset that comes into corporate culture and corporate innovation, I think, is when you're in an organization that's doing well or has achieved a certain level of success, it's easier for folks to kind of want to keep that going, understandably. And so creating psychological safety for people to somehow manage to maintain what is and yet feel motivated to keep growing is so important.
And so, you know, I want to just summarize a lot of the things you said. On the fundraising side, you talked about some three key things. One, really knowing your vision and being able to stick with it. And then the other two of preparing your story based on your financial model and knowing all the different levers in it, and then building that story off of it. And then on the fundraising side, you talked about fighting unconscious bias through diversifying those who are on the investing team, taking a hard look at sometimes why you don't have a diverse set of founders, and finally doing peer-to-peer check-ins. Mm-hmm. Before we leave, is there anything else you want to add on either being a funder or being a fundraiser?
I think one thing I would like to add for anyone who's currently fundraising, sometimes it's very easy to otherize the person on the other side of the table, and to remember that that person who is deploying capital isn't often themselves essentially a startup, because they have their own LPs that they're accountable to, and they've set their own vision for how they're going to deploy that LP's capital. So they're actually in a much more similar situation to you as a founder than you may realize. And I think once you start to recognize that, it also will make you more mindful of how what you're doing can help align with their goals and find those synergies.
That makes me have another question about finding the right fit, right? So it sounds like as a founder, there are certain questions you might want to ask a funder. What are their goals and how do you align and being a good fit? So that way they're not trying to change your company and you're not trying to fit into their portfolio when it might not be. So what are some of those key questions that you think should be asked?
Well, I think even before you get to questions, there's a lot of materials online. Going back to Jenny Fielding made one actually, where there's tools out there where you can build your investor pipeline, for lack of a better word. And essentially what you want to do, you can use tools like Crunchbase and PitchBook and whatnot. You want to look at who are these funds? What stage do they invest at? What is their normal check size? What type of companies do they invest in? They typically all have a thesis that you can uncover again and being curious in your own research. And then you should start to build your list based on that. You know, don't go after someone who only funds Series D if you're trying to raise your first 100K, right? And vice versa. So I think, again, before you even get to questions, you'll uncover a lot just by building that list essentially. And then when you get into that, it's the questions almost that you go into any relationship, right? Like, what are your goals? What are you interested in? You know, I've noticed these are the things that are in your portfolio right now. Is this where you're tending to be for the future? One of the other things too is, are you actually deploying capital right now? Because sometimes it looks like you are and you're not.
That is such an important learning for everyone. You know, it's not just about, my understanding was, it's not just about biases, right? It's also about what state is your VC in, the one that you're approaching. So make sure that they have money.
Yeah, make sure they have the right size check for you. Make sure that, like, some VCs only, or any investors only invest in certain geographies. Some invest in only certain types of businesses or certain business models. Some invest in only certain, you know, technical segments. So knowing that going in, you're gonna be much farther ahead and waste little time if you do that.
That is amazing, Jen. Any last thoughts from you?
No. Okay. A really great conversation.
Same. Let us thank Claudia and Jen once again for such a wonderful conversation, especially Claudia. She agreed to do a part two, and we are so happy that you could find time for us and this time around talk specifically on funding and how one can prepare for that. Guys,
thanks for having me.
Of course, we love chatting with you. You know that. Guys, please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. To stay in touch, you can follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and subscribe to our newsletter to hear about the upcoming events. Spread the word, keep amplifying.